Okay, let's start the next session. So I'm very pleased to be able to introduce Professor Kevin Shilbrack from Appalachian. That's how you pronounce it, Appalachian State University in North Carolina, USA. And I've mentioned Kevin once today already. His book, Philosophy and the Study of Religions, from 2014. Is among his books. He's also edited a couple of books on the philosophy of ritual, philosophical approaches to myth, respectively, and is also the editor of the Blackwell Companion to Religious Diversity, which is due out in, I think, January next year, January 2019. And Kevin's interests are broad-ranging, and Kevin's one of relatively few scholars who can deal sort of competently with both philosophical material and within the study of religions, religious studies more generally. And today, your title, the title of your paper, Kevin, is The Ethics of Religious Diversity. It's still that, right? So Kevin's going to speak on that topic. So please join me in welcoming Kevin.
Such a pleasure to be here. Mick's right about the shift represented by those series of books that popped up on the screen. A broader philosophy of religion, a wider vision, and I see this paper as contributing to that. So the title is The Ethics of Religious Diversity. The longer version has some engagement with Derrida and some other parts that I've cut out for today's presentation. It's pretty focused. So just to jump right in, the question that animates this paper is this: how should one treat those who practice a religion that one doesn't share? The paper begins with some definitions and a way to sort the possible answers. And I talk about the logic of each of those positions and the relationship between them. And then I hope when I'm done, you say, oh, it's obvious what the answer is. Philosophers of religion often treat a religion as a set of beliefs. My students still do that. What do Jews believe? What do Buddhists believe? They ask me. I understand a religion to be a set of embodied practices. A set of practices will be performed by people, of course. And for this reason, even though not all religions include an explicit boundary between insiders and outsiders, nor a conscious choice to join, all religions will be, in the concrete sense, a community of practitioners. Any particular human practice will be structured by the beliefs that make it the practice that it is. And for this reason, even though not all religions include explicit doctrines or a statement of faith, all religions will include religious beliefs. And any practice that's more than ephemeral will be organized according to institutions that reproduce it over time and modify it as necessary. And therefore, even though not all religions include explicit roles or an official hierarchy, all religions will include religious institutions. So by a religion, quote unquote, I mean a set of practices along with the attendant beliefs and institutions performed by a group of people. In short, a form of life. I don't know where I got that phrase from. My dissertation advisor was Paul Griffiths, lately of Duke University, and he called them alien religions, but that phrase always struck me as odd. So the religions of other people will be a form of life made up of a set of religious practices in which one doesn't participate, along with religious beliefs that one doesn't hold and religious institutions one doesn't recognize. So in the concrete, such a religion will be a community of which one is not a member. So the question of my paper is, how should I treat people who practice a religious form of life that I don't share? I want to distinguish this ethical question from two that are closely related. First, the question is not how one should treat the religious other qua human being. The question is not how one should treat religious others when they're hungry or orphaned or displaced. In most cases, that question can be answered without bringing the other person's religion into the moral equation. My question instead concerns how one should treat the other qua religious person, which is to say how one should treat the other as a member of that community that does those religious practices, holds the religious beliefs, and belongs to religious institutions that one doesn't recognize. The question concerns religious others as the practitioners of a form of life that one doesn't practice. Second, my question concerns how one should treat religious others rather than the question of how religious people treat others. If one asks that empirical question about how those in religious communities tend to treat people, the answer is that they tend to be tolerant toward their religious kin and intolerant towards outsiders. But unlike that empirical question, my interest here is normative, and my question concerns not only how religious people should treat those in other religions, but how anyone should. So the scope of the question here is broader, more inclusive. Okay, now to the question itself. I think it's wrong to think that history has been dominated by the persecution of those who practice other religions. Sometimes religious others have been persecuted, shunned, or exiled, or outlawed, or killed because of their religion. But sometimes the religious practices and beliefs and institutions of other people are respected and they're admired. They come to appeal to those who are not members of the religion, and then they get consciously or unconsciously kidnapped and adopted. Throughout history, one sees a syncretistic churn of constant religious borrowing and transformation. And this mix of competition and struggle on the one hand, and emulation and admiration on the other hand, began even before the term religion emerged. That's controversial, but I think it's true, even in ancient India, even in the indigenous peoples that Mick was talking about in China, even before they had a word for religion, which may be a Western word, Buddhists and Confucians were struggling against each other and stealing from each other's ideas. So, to sort the variety of positions that one might take on the ethics of religious diversity, consider these two questions about a religion that one doesn't share. The first question is this: are there good reasons for me to borrow from this form of life? And the second question is, are there good reasons for me to permit others to practice this form of life? Now, each of these questions is complex and rich. The first question, whether there are good reasons for me to borrow from another form of life, it raises the possibility that the religious others community teaches something that's true and that one doesn't yet know. It also raises the possibility that their practices are beneficial, or that their institutions enable ways of living that are better than what one has now. It raises the possibility that those who participate in that way of life experience something that's real that non-participants have not yet seen. The second question, whether there are good reasons to permit others to practice their way of life, considers the skeptical possibility, as Pierre Bayle argued, that there's no way to know for certain that other people's religions are the false ones. It considers the epistemic possibility, as John Locke argued, that given the inability of weapons to reach another person's conscience, trying to coerce them to believe what one wants them to believe will always fail. It considers the liberal possibility, as John Stuart Mill argued, that unless the religious other is harming others, depriving them of their freedom to practice their religion is not as valuable as respecting their ability to choose their own lives. For simplicity's sake, I just want to consider yes and no answers to the two questions. And when you do that, three distinct positions emerge. In the first position are those who answer both questions with a no. They hold a negative evaluation of the other form of life, both for oneself, for themselves, and for the person who practices it. They say something like this: in my judgment, what this other religious community teaches is false, what they practice is harmful. It would be bad for me to adopt these false beliefs and these harmful practices, and there's no reason, good reason for me to borrow from them. In fact, it's also bad for others to hold these false beliefs and to engage in these harmful practices, and there's no good reason why they should be permitted to practice it. So that's my first position, the no, no answers to the two questions. Call that position opposition. In the second position are those who answer the first question with a no, but the second with a yes. They say something like this: from my perspective, what this other community teaches is false, and what they practice is harmful. It would be bad for me to adopt these false beliefs and harmful practices, and there's no good reason for me to borrow from them. It's also bad for others to hold these false beliefs and to engage in these harmful practices. But there are good reasons why they should be permitted to practice their religion, and therefore, even though I don't agree with this form of life, I won't oppose it, but rather will permit those who practice it to do so. And call that second position toleration. So that's the no, yes position. And in the third position, as you probably guessed, there's people who answer both questions with a yes. In response to the first question, they say something like this: what this other religious community teaches may not be completely false. What they practice might not be completely harmful. And if so, there could be good reasons why I should borrow elements from this form of life, from this other religious community. There might be things that I can learn from them. This question came up at the end of your question, the question and answer session about the indigenous religions. Are there things that we can learn from these this poetry of life? It's not surprising that those who give a positive answer like this to the first question will answer the second question by saying that these religious others should be permitted to practice their religion. So in this third position, neither answer is negative, and I call the third position hospitality. Of course, a pure version of opposition or tolerance or hospitality would be an abstraction, and most of those who have considered the ethics of religious diversity have espoused some mixed position. Some have identified one of these three positions as the moral ideal, but then they have applied it only to some religious forms of life and not others. John Locke, for instance, argued that toleration was the principle that could end the violence between warring Protestant churches, but he didn't extend the principle to Catholics or to atheists. I think John Stuart Mill did the same thing 100 years later, at least to Catholics. 100 years later. Some have identified one of these three options as the moral ideal, but then they applied it to only some parts of a religious form of life, but not other parts of the same form of life. The Supreme Court of the United States has a decision where they tolerated the Mormon belief in polygamy, but they outlawed the practice. And conversely, there are many people who will hospitably adopt the practices of meditation or yoga, but they merely tolerate the beliefs in devotion or reincarnation that traditionally justified those practices. Stephen Batchelor is maybe a famous example of an American Buddhist who says, you can do the practices, you just got to drop reincarnation. You just got to drop the parts that are not acceptable. So these examples of how one should treat religious others are only partial, but they're nevertheless genuine. One also sees in history plenty of those who espouse one of these three positions of opposition and toleration and hospitality as the moral ideal in their words, but not in their actions. Thomas More, for instance, described toleration as the best state of a commonwealth in utopia. That's 1516. But when the Reformation actually arrived in England 10 years later, he argued for the execution of heretics, a position that he perhaps came to regret. That was a joke, but not a funny joke. So there's plenty of people, in other words, who lobby for one moral ideal only as an imaginative exercise, or they change their minds, or they're hypocrites. When looking at actual cases, then, actual philosophers who espouse one of these moral ideals, I think we have to keep in mind that a moral position doesn't exist above social disputes, but emerges from within them, so that what any particular thinker intends will always be tied to her social and historical context. Nevertheless, despite the messiness of the actual world, I think that one can use the two questions that I laid out behind my typology to identify the basic commitments that structure the range of possible positions. As one sees in my first question, it's part of the very definition of opposition that one judges the religious other negatively. For those who endorse this position, religious difference is a problem. As one sees in the second question, they seek to solve this problem by eliminating the difference, or in the most severe cases, by eliminating the religious other altogether. The social result pursued by those who espouse opposition is uniformity. As one sees in the first question, it's equally part of the definition of toleration that one judges the religious other negatively. It's because toleration shares the negative evaluation of the religious other that tolerance is not the opposite of intolerance. Despite this overlap between the two positions, the alternative that toleration offers as a moral ideal is revolutionary in that it does not seek to solve the problem of the religious other by eliminating difference. It doesn't seek uniformity. In fact, toleration does not seek to resolve, but merely to contain and diffuse religious disputes. the promise of toleration is that coexistence in disagreement is possible. For this reason, despite the fact that toleration and opposition are both negative, there's a substantive difference between them, and the two should not be collapsed as simply two examples of quote-unquote war by other means. Parenthetically, what lies behind a great deal of this paper is my talking with people who espouse hospitality. This is in large part a critique, or at least a response to hospitality, and they often, I think, dismiss toleration. They're like, oh, that's just opposition again. It's so negative. So I wanted to clearly break the two and show that there are principal differences between them. Okay, so there are advocates of hospitality who treat their ethical position as a significant advance on the other two positions. I was just talking previously about Marianne Moyert in Amsterdam, and she calls it's a transformation from monologue to dialogue. A philosopher named Conway wrote, "This is the hospitality is the movement beyond the insularity of tolerance towards more open and inclusive interactions." I think the two questions in my typology show that their claim of the revolutionary possibility of hospitality is accurate, and how it's accurate. The alternative that hospitality offers as a moral ideal is a second revolution in the ethics of religious diversity. Despite what advocates of hospitality sometimes claim, however, the significance of their position is not the willingness to live with difference. You found that already in toleration. It's not even the respect for other people's religious forms of life. I think you also find that in toleration. The significance is that in the position of hospitality, one drops the negative evaluation of the other person's religious form of life. So when one espouses hospitality as a moral ideal, unlike with either opposition or tolerance, one raises the possibility of borrowing from the practices, beliefs, institutions, and experiences of the religious other. So for the first time, there's the possibility of learning from those whose religion one doesn't share. So that's my map. That's my typology. Let me check the time. Which of the three positions is the one that we want? There's a common tendency today to think that opposition to the religious other is a refusal to treat the other ethically. Endorsed by fundamentalists and extremists, opposition seems medieval, or tribal, or backwards. Perhaps opposition should be left behind. By contrast, those who champion toleration take an accommodationist, quote-unquote, live-and-let-live stance, and they repudiate religious violence. They seek coexistence based on principled non-interference. From the perspective of many of those who endorse hospitality, toleration is a step in the right direction, but it's still too negative, still too limited in its appreciation of the other, still too closed-minded. Hospitality, by contrast, welcomes and risks one's own transformation by the religious other. I was actually talking to a Derrida scholar this week talking about this paper, and he said, if you endorse hospitality, you reject toleration. There's a book with Habermas and Derrida where he says, that's the book you need to read. You'll see how bad Habermas is, how bad the liberal project was. So can we say that in the contemporary world, we want to move past opposition and toleration, and the position that we want is hospitality? I think the answer is no, not exactly. I think the situation is more complex. So now I'm turning to the logic of the three positions and the relationship between them. To illustrate this, I start with toleration, where I thought that the contrast was clearest. So toleration is commonly defined in terms of two elements. Number one, one disapproves of something. And number two, nevertheless, in accord with some principle, one chooses not to interfere, but rather to permit the thing. I wish that you wouldn't smoke in my car, but out of the sake of our friendship, I tolerate it. If one doesn't disapprove of the thing in question, for example, if one's simply indifferent, then strictly speaking, one's not tolerating. Or if one would like to interfere, but one lacks the ability, for example, if one's outnumbered, or if one has given up and become resigned to the thing one doesn't like, then again, strictly speaking, one's not tolerating. So we might call a definition like this with these two elements generic, since it's neutral about the moral status of the thing that's being tolerated. A generic definition of toleration, the kids are making too much noise, you're smoking in my car, what have you. These are fine when one seeks to describe all the different ways that people put up with things that they don't care for. But it doesn't work for the definition of toleration as a virtue. And so it doesn't help with the answering of the ethical question that I'm pursuing in this question, in this paper. The problem with the generic definition is that it includes two kinds of toleration that are not virtuous. On the one hand, it includes those situations when someone tolerates something that, morally speaking, shouldn't be tolerated. It includes, for example, the person, let's call him Carl, who disapproves when his friend uses date rape drugs, but out of respect, inspired by John Stuart Mill, for his friend's rights to make his own decisions, he doesn't oppose it. Carl is tolerating something in the generic sense, but we wouldn't praise him, or I wouldn't praise him because I want to make these normative steps that my vacationing friends don't want to make. I wouldn't praise this as virtuous toleration. The action that Carl is tolerating does deserve disapproval, and Carl does disapprove of it. But if the action shouldn't be permitted, then to tolerate it is not a virtue. The problem in this case arises not in the first part of my generic definition, do you disapprove of the thing? It arises with the second half about, for some principled reason, are you not interfering? To specify toleration in the ethical sense, that is the virtue of toleration, we need to recognize a moral threshold that the thing tolerated rises above. For an act of toleration to count as a virtue, it must be of an action that's not morally intolerable. I said there was two problems. That's the first half. On the other hand, the generic definition also includes those situations when someone tolerates something to which, morally speaking, they shouldn't even object. It includes, for example, the person, let's call her Marie, who disapproves when her friend falls in love with someone of the same sex. But out of a recognition, perhaps inspired by John Locke, that one cannot coerce another person's mind, she doesn't oppose it. She is again tolerating something in the generic sense, but I wouldn't praise her as virtuous. The action that Marie is tolerating should be permitted, and she does permit it. But if the action is not one that merits disapproval, then to tolerate it is not a virtue. The problem in this case arises not in the second part of my generic definition, but with the first half. Did you disapprove of it? To specify toleration in the ethical sense, or the virtue of toleration, we have to recognize a moral ceiling that the thing tolerated is below. For an act of toleration to count as a virtue, it must not be of an action that's morally unobjectionable. So the conclusion of the argument to this point is that an act of toleration is not virtuous if the tolerated thing is not morally tolerable. The character of the tolerated thing is crucial. This conclusion applies no less when one's discussing the toleration of religious diversity. The same threshold and ceiling exist. It's not a virtue to tolerate religious beliefs and practices that are morally impermissible. Someone who said that she didn't agree with the murders and kidnappings of children by Joseph Kony and the Lord's Resistance Army, but that she tolerated them because they were based on sincerely held religious beliefs, would not be tolerating in a virtuous way. Similarly, it's also not a virtue to tolerate religious beliefs and practices that are morally praiseworthy. Someone who said that he didn't agree with the boycotts and the marches for racial equality led by Martin Luther King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, but he was willing to tolerate them, would not be virtuous. When religious behavior fails to rise above the moral threshold, or it rises above the moral ceiling, when it's not in that window, toleration is not the morally appropriate response. In these two kinds of cases, refusing to interfere with the action is a form of toleration, but in neither case is it a virtuous form of toleration. Because a person or an action is only tolerant in the virtuous sense when it responds appropriately to the character of the thing that she's dealing with, and tolerates something that morally can be tolerated, a person who espouses toleration as a moral ideal has to recognize, that is, she's logically required to recognize, that there are some things that she shouldn't tolerate, there are some things that she should oppose. When she opposes these things, she does so virtuously. Toleration depends upon an accurate reading of the world, It is in this sense conditional or situation dependent. The point that I'm making right now has classical roots. Aristotle said that those who, out of a desire to avoid conflict, indiscriminately praise the words and deeds of others and do not oppose them are not virtuous, they are rather obsequious. Those who don't care whether they cause others pain and indiscriminately oppose what others do and say are equally off the mark. The translation is churlish. We don't use obsequious enough, probably, or churlish. But the virtuous position, and this is Aristotle, the virtuous position is to put up with the things that one should put up with and to resent the things that one should resent. I said that that point has classical roots because I don't know that Aristotle actually recognizes toleration as a virtue. I don't think that's in his list of virtues, and I'm not sure that classical thinkers in general thought toleration was a virtue. But nevertheless, he is making this realist, moral realist point that just to be nice or just to be mean indiscriminately it isn't virtuous. You need to tailor what you do to the character of the thing that you're responding to. So my example was with toleration, but I want to argue that all the virtues operate like this. All the virtues depend for their value on the agent responding accurately to the moral character of the thing that they're dealing with. We therefore also have to make a distinction between generic and virtuous senses of opposition and hospitality, just as I did with toleration. There's opposition in a generic sense when someone doesn't permit something, and opposition to the narrower sense as a virtue when someone doesn't permit something that shouldn't be permitted. It follows there's also opposition to the religious other in a virtuous sense when someone doesn't permit something religious that should not be permitted. I previously gave the example of Koenig's child soldiers. I would add George W. Bush's so-called crusade into Iraq, Anders Breivik's Odinist killing spree, the Islamic State throwing gay men from rooftops, Jim Jones's poisoned Kool-Aid. In the longer version of this paper, I criticize those people who endorse hospitality for also endorsing Hicks' pluralism. It's as if all religions are good, and therefore you're mean if you're not hospitable to them. Whereas I think a list like this helps us keep in mind the richness of the religious phenomenon we should be talking about. Analogously, there's hospitality in a generic sense whenever someone welcomes something, but there's hospitality in a virtuous sense only when someone welcomes something that should be welcomed. And there's hospitality to the religious other in a virtuous sense only when someone welcomes none of the practices that I just listed, but only those religious practices that deserve it. The opposition and toleration or hospitality that we want is going to be a conditional opposition, a conditional toleration, a conditional hospitality. That's what I previously referred to as the logic of each of these positions. So we're now at a point where we can recognize the relationship between these three positions. Hopefully this will answer the question of my title. As I noted previously, the moral task that's taken on by those who espouse toleration as an ethical ideal requires one to distinguish between a moral floor, a moral ceiling, and the space between them. In this way, toleration requires one to sort things into three categories: those which are morally intolerable and must be opposed, like recruiting child soldiers by having them kill their parents; which things are morally blameworthy and should not be judged negatively, like protests of racism; and which things fall between this floor and the ceiling, the things that one doesn't accept for oneself, but can be tolerated. If this sorting metaphor is right, then opposition is not what the tolerant person hopes for, but it is still a response that is part of their palette, the paint palette. It's part of the palette of toleration as a moral ideal, and necessarily so. The tolerant person will sometimes oppose. But the opposite isn't true. The moral task that's taken on by those who espouse opposition as an ethical ideal is to sort the practices, beliefs, and institutions of the religions one doesn't share into just two categories. There are those things which deserve to be opposed and those things which are not relevant. The latter is the category of adiaphora, probably pronouncing that wrong, the indifferent. So for those who espouse opposition as their ethical ideal, there's no third category for things one doesn't like but doesn't oppose. So we can see that opposition only has two categories: should I oppose it or should I be indifferent? whereas toleration asks whether one should oppose it, be indifferent, or tolerate. In this way, toleration is a more complex moral position. In fact, toleration has opposition as a moral option nested within it. Toleration is superior to opposition. It's a richer palette. Hospitality, now, turning to the last option, is the more complex. As with toleration and opposition, hospitality as a moral ideal requires one to respond accurately to the world. Hospitality is a virtue only when one is welcoming what deserves to be welcomed. And so hospitality is conditional, like the other two virtues. But hospitality is the most complex position of the three because it includes this new option, this positive, open, welcoming response that was not recognized as a possibility in opposition and was not recognized as a possibility in toleration, the possibility of learning from the religious other. The moral task that's taken on by those who espouse hospitality as a moral ideal, therefore, is to sort things into four categories. Is the thing something that deserves indifference? Or should I tolerate it? Should I oppose it? Or can I welcome it and learn from it? Hospitality is therefore the position that we want, but hospitality does not refer simply to welcoming beliefs, practices, and institutions of the religious other. Hospitality is conditional, and it depends on an accurate judgment of that to which one is responding. Hospitality as an ethical position does not leave opposition or toleration behind, but it instead refers to a complex task of sorting that includes opposing what should be opposed, tolerating what deserves to be tolerated, and now for the first time, cultivating the attitudes of open-mindedness that permit one to learn from those who practice the religions that one doesn't share. Thank you guys very much for your attention.